This is David Rutledge, and this is the Earshot podcast, bringing you stories in sound. Today, we have a tale of taxidermy. One of my favourite websites is devoted to bad taxidermy. There's something hilarious and terrifying about a badly executed stuffed animal. But even when it's done well, I've always thought that there's something a little strange and gothic about taxidermy. And today's story has both challenged and strengthened that prejudice. Joe Bain is a very good taxidermist. He's employed at the South Australian Museum, and he's worked on everything from tiny spiders to blue whales and 500 million-year-old fossils. Producer Mike Ladd is about to take us into Joe's workshop. Here's Sculpture with Skin.
Skeletons, a stuffed sea turtle, the spiky orange head of a giant oarfish, guide me down to Joe Bain's basement workshop behind the South Australian Museum.
An invaluable part of my workshop is this overhead gantry. When you're working on large animals, it's the only thing you can use to sort of lift them up and do the work.
What are some of the sort of things you've hoisted on that?
Plesiosaurs, white sharks, the cassowary in the freezer will be in a couple of weeks' time. Yeah, all sorts of things. Or even wombats, you know. A wombat might weigh to 40, 50 kilograms, and they're pretty difficult to manipulate while you're skinning them, but you can hook them up by their back legs while you're doing the work, and it makes your life a whole lot easier and safer.
Drills and scalpels on the benches, 44-gallon drums and an acid bath at the back, a tanned crocodile skin pinned to the wall beside us. Overhead, an ancient-looking goblin shark, dangling, goggle-eyed.
For me, my history of the museum goes back a long way. I mean, one of my earliest memories was as an 18-month-old child. And apparently, I had a favourite gallery in the museum, and it was a skeleton gallery. I came to the museum one day with my grandmother, and it was closed. I was inconsolable. I started crying. I threw a tantrum and hid under the bat case, and it took three security guards with brooms to get me out, you know, pushing me out. But from that day forward, I was obsessed with the museum. I always have been. And I know as a very young child, so 10 years old, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. My career was set. It was to be a taxidermist. I mean, as a child, you know, you learn things die. And for me, it was profound. These things that are so marvellous have an end, and so we need to use them in another way. And so for me, it was the most sensible thing to do. And it still is.
A bird snap-necked by the window. A spider curled up in the sink. A mouse staring with startled eyes from the kitchen trap. Somewhere in early childhood, most of us make the huge discovery that as well as life, there's death. Don't touch, the adults say. And so begins the retreat, the avoidance, the hiding. But from an early age, Joe Bain thought it was a waste to simply ignore or discard the dead, and got to work doing something about it.
I had an old kitchen table in the shed, and I had various tools that I'd managed to save up for, or improvise. And what it was, you know, whenever we'd go out in the car, I'd have my head out the window looking for dead things by the side of the road. I had a friend who had a market garden, and ducklings would die, chickens would die, and so I'd get those. Even at school, you know, there was a dead seagull on the oval, and I was given that. And that's actually in a cupboard here. It's one of those things that you're always on the lookout for.
But how did you learn to preserve them? I mean, rather than them all just going off in your shed?
Well, it's an odd thing. My uncle was a taxidermist, and I knew he'd done a little bit of taxidermy because as a child, you know, you'd walk into my uncle's room at my grandmother's place, and it was full of stuff, and it was fantastic. I mean, you had fish, you had peacocks, you had pheasants. I mean, it was just extraordinary. Now, when I asked my uncle years later, how did you learn from my Uncle Rob, I used to get all sorts of, you know, insight, and he'd give me instruction. He had some books. And I asked him how he learned, you know, did you learn from books as well? He says, oh, no, your grandfather taught me. And I said, well, I had no idea. I mean, I knew he kept them. I didn't know he preserved them as well. He said, oh, yeah. Yeah, he learned from his father. He was a big taxidermist. And in the old house on Fullerton Road, there was a conservatory that was full of stuff. And apparently they had this massive old house on Fullerton Road, and the back conservatory had a huge tree in it, a dead tree, and it was covered in birds. And the ground was littered with all sorts of other animals. And so it was, you know, a really substantial collection. I mean, he was a career taxidermist. I know when kids decide to become obsessive about something, I mean, parents often think it'll go away if we just ignore it. And I think there was a bit of that. My mother in particular just thought it was a phase and it would go away. My grandmother was very encouraging because she saw what Rob had done, and she thought there was real potential. It was people at school that were more concerned. I mean, I know I had counselling from the school careers counsellor, and I think, you know, serial killer was probably ringing in their ears at the time. I mean, like the company of dead things rather than living things. But, you know, it was never about killing anything, or it was never anything malicious. It was really about utilising a resource that's not used.
How did you get into the South Australian Museum?
My predecessor, a fellow by the name of Winston Head, had given a public lecture. And prior to then, I'd written to the museum asking for work experience. I was turned down because I was too young. I came into this public lecture, I think it was just 14, and I had a chat to him, and he said, well, you're too young. We only accept people when they're 15, so try again then. And so I did. I wrote in and didn't get an answer, so I wrote in again. I made phone calls. And I know now Winston was a busy man. I mean, that's the fact of it. And he didn't want to be bothered by snotty-nosed 14-year-old. So when I finally got in, he was doing field work. It was Friday afternoon, and Winston came back from field work, and he was putting stuff in his office. And I fronted up to him. I said, listen, I'm really annoyed with you. I wanted to spend 2 weeks learning to see if this is a career I should follow, and you've avoided me. I'm really annoyed. And I think it's the first time I actually swore in an adult. I was so irritated. And he says, yeah, I have been avoiding you. I'm sorry. Look, come back Monday, and we'll see where we go from there. And it was one of the best weeks of my life. He says, I never shut up. I just ask questions because I had an idea of what I wanted to do. I tried all sorts of techniques. I had failings. I had successes. And I wanted to compare them with someone who did this all their life. And for me, it was the start of something that was just phenomenal.
In the succession line of taxidermists at the museum, one of the most colourful was the first, George Beasley, who came out from England in 1881 and whose handiwork is still on display. In particular, the larger beasts in the old mammal gallery.
So this is an interesting item. This is George Beasley's stuffing rod. And so it would have been used during the taxidermy of larger animals, like the elephant, the moose, a couple of bears perhaps. And I know we had some large seals that he would have done as well.
It's a like a giant darning needle.
Well, you see this notched end that was used to grab bales of hay, and it's got a handle at the end, and it just would have been used to manipulate these things, these bales of hay underneath the skin to arrange correct musculature. Because in those days, you'd skin an animal, quite often the skin wouldn't be tanned, and then you just arrange the hay inside so it looked natural. Mm. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't.
And that was used for an elephant, was it?
Yes, our elephant on display, Miss Siam.
Yeah.
George Beasley was the first taxidermist at the South Australian Museum. He was actually brought out by the director at the time to help build this fledgling museum. And George was a really colourful character. He was a bit of a drinker. And in those days, you mixed up animal skin glue and you had it in a pot. His would contain some sort of hooch that he'd drink. When you make skeletons, you cut off a lot of meat. That meat gets thrown away. he would use that meat to grow maggots that he'd then sell to all the fishing and tackle shops around Adelaide. So he had a bit of a reputation about doing things outside the box, which irritated people. So he was spoken to about it. And probably being under the influence part of the time while you're working isn't the best thing for working relationships either. So he had real problems with museum management. He hated them. There were a number of documented stand-up fights, screaming sessions, you know, him destroying things. And what he did to get this vitriol out, he'd write long letters expounding just how incompetent museum management were, or the character of their wives, etc. You know, it was really quite nasty stuff. He'd write these letters and he'd bury them in the wadding when he was stuffing animals. But it's more than that. I mean, if you walk through the mammal gallery today, you'll see our moose. And he's a gorgeous-looking moose, and he was one of the early things that George did. Unfortunately, he's got a bit of a lean on his head. His head's twisted. And this occurred sometime during George's final days here. There was a Christmas celebration. George came drunk, abusive, tried to ride the moose while naked, and was promptly removed. Now, when they tried to pull him off the moose, he had hold of one of its horns and bent and twisted its neck. He was then thrown out, and he was actually sent back to England and never heard from again.
So those letters are still up in some of those mammals, are they, in the gallery?
I suspect the moose is chock-a-block full of them. This is a goblin shark, and if you have a look at it, it was mounted in 1914. It's got a bit of damage, but it opens a nice flap underneath, and it shows you how tightly packed they are with hay. Now, early taxidermists were often upholsterers, and so you find these things quite often look like stuffed pillowcases more than they look the actual animal that they should.
Joe doesn't just stuff things. His card says Supervisor of Three-Dimensional Design. He sculpts, carves, moulds and casts. Even uses a 3D printer to create body parts. He works with fossils, the most ancient of the dead, as well as creatures who were living only yesterday.
My typical approach to my work is that if we're having an exhibition, I'll go to my freezer and check a catalogue of what I've got in the freezer. I've got a network of people who find dead things for me and bring it in. And these are people that range from national parks to the zoo to people who run private wildlife places. And so I've got a good catalogue of this material. I'll get something out, I'll defrost it, or it might come in fresh. So you've got a dead animal that's either been hit by a car or died of natural causes. In the case of a mammal, you know, you take all sorts of appropriate measurements, depending on how it's being presented in the case. I mean, if it's a kangaroo and it's standing up with its chest upright, you don't want to make an incision down the middle of its chest. You do it down the back, some place where it's not going to be seen. You make your first incision and you then remove the skin. And it's important that this be done without stretching the skin, without putting any major holes in the skin. And you need to separate the skin, and depending on the size of the animal, you either cover it in a material called borax, which is a preserving agent, or you, if it's larger, you need to salt it. It may need tanning. From that skinned body, you take an incredible multitude of measurements. You need to know where everything goes. Depending on the size of the animal, you might just carve a body in foam and use those measurements to rebuild the body. If it's really large, you remove all the meat from the body, you mount the skeleton, and you rebuild the animal in clay. You mould and cast it, and you cast it in a really dense polyurethane foam. That way, when the skin is tanned, you can put the skin over the top, and you use a glue to actually hold it in place, sew it up, and that's it. It sounds easy, but it's not. It's with a large animal, it's months of work. With a small animal, you know, it may be a day, but it's fever pitched. You're working the entire time against the clock. You're working with biological materials that degrade, and they degrade from the moment that animal dies. So you really don't have long.
What's the largest animal you've ever worked on yourself?
The largest animal I've worked on is the largest animal on Earth. I mean, the blue whale. We've worked on those to, you know, remove the skeleton. It's one of the things as a taxidermist, you're not sitting down doing the same thing day in, day out. And it's one of the things that I love about this work. I've worked on everything from blue whales to minute spiders that are 2 millimetres across. they've had to be preserved for display. It's all part of the job.
The thing about Joe is he hates to kill anything. From childhood, his passion for taxidermy has been about preserving life, not taking it. He wants to stop death becoming decay, to halt the process of time. And yes, he's been a vegetarian for almost 40 years.
Someone stole our Thorny Mountain Devil from a case in the museum. And it was terrible, because I thought, you know, who would do that? Because this is for the public good. Our curator of reptiles said, well, next time I'm up north, I'll grab one for you and you can knock it on the head and stuff it. Now, I was horrified. I mean, honestly, it was just the worst thing I could imagine. And so I developed this technique of using all the preserved material we have in jars to mould it, to cast it in a flexible material, incorporating a wire skeleton, and then posing it. It would then be painted. And so this at the time was seen as ridiculous. It was all about Joe avoiding killing something. I was seen as a bit soft. And fine, I don't care. But what it turns out now is we're doing the biodiversity gallery. We needed a collection of rock dragons. We needed a dozen of them. If we went to an area and collected 12 rock dragons to skin and mount, we'd cause a local extinction. I can go to the collection, I can mould two of them, we can pose them differently and paint them. These things, they're quicker to do, they're cheaper to do, they last longer, and they look better. And so Joe being soft has not only saved lives in the field, but it's also made a work practice, you know, more cost effective. So I think that's really important too.
What's in the drawer over here?
These are some of my favourite bits. These
are the eye drawer.
German crystal eyes. Now, these things were bought by the museum director, Herbert Hale. This drawer here has the actual samples he was sent back in the early, well, sort of the late 30s.
And, oh, they're beautiful.
Yeah.
Like little jewels.
So these things were made by German crystal manufacturers. And if you look at sort of a couple of these boxes, you can see every colour you can imagine, these guys made them. Even down to these lovely, the rabbit, little rabbit eyes, you know. Like,
oh, like pink eyes for a rabbit.
Absolutely, beautiful. Oh. But, you know, during World War II, all the factories were destroyed and they're no longer made. So these are the last that you'll find.
Wow. So where do you get eyes from now?
Well, now there's a number of American manufacturers. And if I show you these ones here, these are a lion eyes.
Oh.
And so they're made quite differently. They're rather thin. Mm. They're still glass. They're high-density sort of glass. But they don't have the sort of the fluid look that I think the really old ones do have.
Yeah. Amazing. And what about all these little black ones?
Well, for all your nocturnal animals, you know, possums and things like that, you've got all these lovely black beads. These are, in fact, not glass eyes, but hat pins from the early part of, you know, the 20th century. You know, they have these hat pins to hold their hats on. Yeah. And so that's what they are, but, you know, they're used here for eyes.
And what about this big clear one? Is it an underwater
one? A lot of these are sort of flint eyes, you know, they have no colour. And this oval sort of pupil is been used for a deer.
Oh, okay.
And you simply paint the vein pattern on the back and install them. So these are really quite good, these clear ones, because you can adapt them to any sort of animal. For instance, these ones that are completely clear, you know, if you look at a box of those, that size I could use for a bird. I could even use it for a small crocodile, simply by painting a different pupil and different colour iris on. So, very adaptable.
Beautiful.
As we pass by Joe's walk-in freezer, a rank fishy smell, like an old tin of tuna, assaults my nose.
That's the fridge, so just thinking of that smell.
What's that smell? Has something gone off, has it?
No. Everyone thinks dolphins are lovely. I hate them because they smell. And that's dolphin smell you can smell.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're rank animals.
So are you preserving one, are you? You're preserving one?
No, if one goes into the freezer forever smells like dolphin.
Do you need a strong stomach for this kind of work? Like...
Sorry. Sometimes you do need a strong stomach for this work. I mean, I'm a very lucky person in that I can count the number of times I've vomited in my entire life on one hand. Sometimes things do smell, and when you're working with skeletons in particular, And to the joy of my co-workers a while ago, I very nearly lost it in the sink just over there, simply because I was working on a kangaroo, and this thing had been macerated, so all the meat had been removed from its bones. Now, to aid drying of the skeleton and further mounting, I need to drill holes in those bones. One thing I didn't realise up until that day, freshwater maceration does not remove the marrow that's inside the bones. And this marrow had been sitting in there rotting for about 12 weeks, submerged in water. And that was the first time I nearly lost my lunch at work. I mean, I've waded through whale and all sorts of things, but this was really bad.
Let's come up and see what's in the bathtub. What's going on here?
This is one of my older specimens at the moment. This is a, if you have a look, this is a an ichthyosaur. You can just see the end of its snout there embedded in this rock. Now, this is a process of acid digestion, and that's the back of his head. You can see his eye quite clearly there. This is part of his snout. Another part of the snout, you can just see the teeth starting to come through.
Yeah.
So these things resemble dolphins in many ways, but were about 6 metres long. Lived in Australia about 120 million years ago, when South Australia was covered by ocean. So these guys were swimming around, dodging icebergs, eating everything in their path.
So you're dissolving away the stone with this. Obviously, it's not too strong, that acid, because you just put your hands in it.
Absolutely. The acid I use is actually comparable to vinegar. It actually dissolves the limestone really well. So it goes in this very dilute acetic acid for about a week. It then gets rinsed in water. And then I take specimens out like this. And anything that's newly exposed, I coat in an acrylic resin and then pop it back in the acid. So it's a process that does take a long time, but it gives you beautiful results.
At the moment, Joe has a special guest in his freezer. Alexander was a greater flamingo, and up until last year, he was the oldest one in the world. Named after Alexander the Great, he arrived at the Adelaide Zoo sometime around 1930.
Now, it's really special because he's 83 years old. At least 83, that is. You know, he came to the zoo as an adult, and so he may be much older than that. We don't know. But certainly, one of the things about Alexander, he's a singular character. When you look at him, he's got these lovely wrinkles, and he's got arthritis in his ankles, and they're the things that make Alexander Alexander. When you do normal bird mounts, what happens is the skin dries around the face, and so you lose all those wrinkles. One of the other problems is you need to put a leg wire up the back of the leg bones to support the mount. Now, when you look at his legs, they're impossibly thin. I mean, they're less than 10 mil across in some places. I need to put about a 12 mil rod up the back of his leg. It's going to look dreadful. And so one of the things I want to do is a technique that I've used on apes. And it's a moulding and casting technique. The problem is I've never tried it on a bird. The other solution to his legs is this as well. If I mould his legs in the pose I want them, I can then insert the right diameter rod inside, pour resin in, and we'll end up with perfect legs in every respect with the rod hidden inside the cast. Now, I want a stand-in bird, and I've been after an ibis for a year. Now, everyone's telling me they're in plague proportions, you know, that they annoy them, they wake them up, they crap all over their driveways, but no one's yet brought in a dead one. And they've got to be dying somewhere. So all I want to do is get one bird, one ibis, so that I can do a complete mount just to check. Because I'm 99% sure, but when you've got one bird, and one bird like Alexander, you don't want to mess it up because there are no do-overs. So, yeah, he awaits his time in the freezer, he's properly wrapped, and he'll last there for a few years without any damage whatsoever until we've got that practice bird. So this is our fridge area. This is where we defrost specimens, and I keep silicon rubbers to keep them cool. Now, just here is our freezer. Okay. Now, it's minus 25, it's very cold, so don't lick anything. So as you can see, it's a little crowded at the moment. One of the things taking up the most room is this cassowary, which recently died at the zoo, that we want to preserve
for a new part of the mammals gallery. And I know a bird's not a mammal, but we're going to change the mammal gallery slightly to include some of our larger birds.
That's a dramatic sight, those cassowary claws sticking out.
But as you can see, you know, everything's catalogued, you know, everything's got names on it, we know where everything is, and although it's very packed, you know, it shows you I have another lifetime of work to do.
And where's Alexander?
Alexander is on the shelf up there, wrapped quite securely. I know exactly where he is at all times.
Good luck, Alexander.
Certainly nice and cool.
It's so cool.
My work means more than just the object. I make sure that I try and imbue these things with the character that they had when they're alive. It's not just a simple mechanical technique. So for me, it's very much art. Taxidermy really is sculpture with skin. If you look at the way they did it in the old days, it's more like stuffing a pillowcase. You know, you'd have a skin body and you'd be ramming it full of hay as hard as you can, sewing it up and nailing its feet to the floor. And that's the description that was given to me by an old taxidermist, a 91-year-old taxidermist. But nowadays, it really is about sculpting this body form, making sure it's absolutely right. You know, it's in the pose, it's got the attitude right, and then finishing it off with a coating of skin. So it really is sculpture with skin.
After I say goodbye to Joe, I head back to the main building of the museum to take one more look at that moose of George Beasley's.
Ah, now here's the moose in the mammal gallery. And he does look a little twisted. And what sort of secret documents are hiding in there, Ryan?
Sculpture with Skin featured taxidermist Joe Bain. The sound engineer and bass player was Tom Henry, and production there was by Mike Ladd. And by the way, Joe's still looking for a dead ibis to practice on, so if you happen to have one handy, you know, that dead ibis you've had in the fridge for a few days, I'm sure he'd love to hear from you. Just contact us at the Earshot website, where you'll also find some photos of Joe's workshop and that intriguing kinky moose. And this has been RN's Earshot podcast. Thanks very much for your company. I'm David Rutledge. Bye for now.
As any decent parent will tell you, it's important to eat your vegetables. And that's advice that researchers at the German Aerospace Centre in Bremen have taken very much to heart. They're busy designing an onboard greenhouse for use on a future mission to Mars. It's about nutrition, oxygen levels, and keeping astronauts sane on that long, long journey to the red planet. That's Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.